for coming out here. Now, on this talk, I'm mostly going to be the bearer of bad news. You know, some people are gluttons for punishment. Wally is. He gets empowered to know how he's getting screwed over. And I agree with him. I think you can't change anything until you understand how it works and why it works. This is my bad news talk for the most part. I'm going to try to tell you concretely how our journalism works the way it does, why it does, and give some concrete examples of recent crucial stories and go through them to show you how it works. And I think implicit in this, and certainly explicit in my presentation, will be an explanation of why this is disastrous for democracy and why we've got to change our media and change our journalism if we're going to have a viable democracy. And it's not really an abstract matter. It's not really we're talking about some sort of tangential issue, but it goes right to the heart of the future of this country. It's absolutely central to what direction this country and frankly, this planet's going to go in the next 25, 50, 75 years. The politics of media, which I've talked about in all my other talks, how we can change it, how what we can do to improve the system, I'm going to lay off in this talk, therefore. This is the critique that leads to that talk. This is the talk I should have given first, but I'm giving it last. But the point you should keep in the back of your mind throughout this talk, which should be clear, I hope, is that media systems are created, like Wally said, they're the result of public policies. All forms of media are regulated. There's no such thing as free media. There's always someone paying the piper or someone calling the tune. The question in a democracy is, whose values are going to be served? How accountable are these media going to be? Who are they going to be accountable to? Those are the central issues that we can affect. And we've got to organize around this issue to change our media. But let's explain what the problem is. Today, let's just talk a little bit about the nature of the problem we're in. Journalism is mandatory in a society, in a governance. I mean, you see it most clearly, the relationship of journalism and governance, when you look at an authoritarian society. When they take over, and there's a coup or something, the first thing they do is take over the TV stations, take over the newspapers, the radio stations, the internet service providers. They understand that control of the means of the communication is central to the exercise of political democracy, or political governance, I should say. In democracies, it's mandatory that you have some sort of decent form of journalism to have self-government make it possible. And the journalism is going to be spawned by your media system. The structure of your system, how it's set up, will go a long way towards determining the quality of the journalism that comes out of that system. Structural issues are mandatory for explaining the nature of your content. What do we need from journalism in a democracy? What are the things we need? Well, what I'm going to say is really standard issue political theory. This is nothing especially radical. Although now to talk about basic democratic theory, you almost want to look over your shoulder. You know, it seems like pretty radical stuff to talk about self-government. What we need from journalism in a democracy are three things. First of all, we need a watchdog over people in power and people who want to be in power, in both the public and private sector. We need them to be held accountable so we know what they're doing. If journalism doesn't do it, we simply don't know. We can't govern ourselves. We can't govern them. We can't rule them. Secondly, we need a wide range of informed opinion on the most important issues of the day. That helps us put together our own opinions. We can evaluate other positions, sift them, debate them, think them through, and then come to an informed decision. Third, we have to have a media system that can generate reliable facts so we can know what the truth is, get to the truth of matters so we can weed out lies from truth. Now, we can't expect every single medium to do that, but what we should expect is that an average person and a citizen would have access to all that material through a combination of media they could be exposed to. That's not too much to ask in a democratic society. That should be our goal. Given that as a goal, what would you say the status of our journalism is today? Well, I'd say I'd give the grade a D-. I think our media, our journalism in particular, is completely failing us. I think in terms of watchdog, and I'll talk about this, the private sector is virtually off limits from any serious watchdog activity, corporate malfeasance. Public sector malfeasance is only within a narrow range covered when there's fights between the two dominant parties. Otherwise, it slides right by without a shred of coverage. Reliable facts, truthfulness, completely discarded for the most part. And I'll talk about that, too, coming up when we discuss the Florida election in 2000. And then third, the range of opinion. I think Jeff Cohen, the founder of Fairness in Action and Reporting, hit the nail on the head. We have a range of opinion in our media system that extends all the way from GE to GM. Now, the reasons for this aren't exclusively corporate control. I'm going to talk a lot later about how corporate concentration, the profit motive, has really squeezed journalism in the last 10 or 15 years. It's a common theme. If you go to Malaprops or even a Borders or Barnes & Noble bookstore, you'll find lots of books by former journalists or even current journalists talking about the crisis of journalism as a public service due to corporate and commercial pressure in the last 10 or 15 years. That's not new. My argument goes a lot deeper than that. My argument goes far beyond. That's part of the problem, but it's not just the problem. So that makes it sound like 20 years ago everything was hunky-dory, and it wasn't. We had problems 20 years ago, very serious problems with our journalism, although it's worse today. And here it's good to think about something called objectivity. Oftentimes I'll talk to people about journalism and they'll say, yeah, you're right, the media suck. And I say, what we need is more objectivity. If they were objective, everything would be fine. It's like the good old days. And they usually use that accent, too. There's a notion that objectivity was something like the Founding Fathers cooked up, like Benjamin Franklin and Tom Paine, you know, Samuel Adams got together in a tavern and said, what sort of journalism would protect democracy? How about objectivity? Nonpartisan, neutral journalism that has no opinion. That's the solution. In fact, objectivity didn't even come about until the beginning of the 20th century. For the first 100-plus years of our history, we had a stridently partisan journalism. The journalism of the Founding Fathers, the journalism of the first three generations of this republic was phenomenally partisan. The front page, you didn't have to wait to the editorial page to know where the newspaper was coming from. The owner, the editor were one and the same. You knew who owned the paper, you knew the politics. They were that person's politics, period. That's how journalism worked for the first 120 years. Nothing objective about it, nothing neutral whatsoever. It was a very different style of journalism than we have today. Objectivity has certain merits we'll talk about, but it also has deep flaws. But let's discuss the origins of objectivity. Why did it pop out of the sky in the early 20th century? Why didn't we continue with the partisan system that worked so well? I mean, some people who study American history to get a sense of the partisan system, look at some of the newspapers if you get a chance during the Civil War. See how the northern newspapers covered Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he was given the worst thing, the biggest right-wing kook ever said about Bill Clinton doesn't come close to the treatment Abraham Lincoln got from the northern press during the Civil War. You want to talk about partisan journalism. It was a stridently partisan institution throughout the 19th century. Well, why did it change? Why didn't it change? Well, this is what happened. Over the course of the 19th century, our newspaper industry became increasingly a capitalist system. It started off as being largely partisan. Its goal was to help parties win elections. Then entrepreneurs figured out you can make a lot of bucks publishing these things and selling them and selling ads. And that logic gradually took over. But the partisanship remained, even though it was now primarily a commercial enterprise. But it was also a much more competitive market. So if you were in a city like St. Louis in 1870 or 1875, there were 15 daily newspapers in St. Louis. All partisan, all had distinct points of views, but there were 15 of them. You could really pick and choose. And the market was so competitive, if you didn't like one of those 15, you could start the 16th paper with a different point of view. It worked pretty well. I mean, there were flaws with it. I don't want to romanticize it, but the partisan system works well as long as you've got a lot of different viewpoints and people can add their new ones. In fact, that's what the First Amendment free press is all about, protecting the ability to start new partisan viewpoints. But what happened? Well, the logic of newspaper economics changed radically toward the late 19th century. What happened was the rise of advertising made it so that most newspaper markets winnowed down to becoming one and two newspaper markets. And by the early 20th century, that was the rule in most small towns. I suspect Asheville, I doubt, had more than two papers or three papers 80 or 100 years ago. Might have only had one, for all I know. Most American cities were like that. Now, partisan journalism, when you've only got one or two newspapers, looks a lot different than when you've got 15. When you've only got one or two newspapers, and it's impossible to start a new newspaper, as it is with newspaper markets, due to the logic of those markets. Stridently partisan journalism smells like month-old fish. It's not unlike the sort of stridently partisan journalism in the Soviet Union, where you had the party line and that was it. You either bought it or you went out, so you had no choice. You couldn't start another paper to compete with it. You're stuck with it. And this partisan journalism of the progressive era, of the first decade of the 20th century, was stridently pro-capitalist and anti-labor. And the dominant social movement of that time was the labor movement. It was the movement of workers to improve the standard of living. And the press couldn't have been more viciously or hostilely or directly anti-labor than they were in the first 10 or 15 years of this century. This became the foundation for the rise of objective or professional journalism. This was a crisis for the system. It was a political crisis in the sense that if you read our magazines and newspapers and the political speeches from that period, this is an obsession of people politically. Upton Sinclair, who wrote The Jungle, wrote a book in 1919 called The Brass Check, which was a critique of the capitalist domination of the news media in this country. He considered it the best book he ever wrote, and it was the most censored book he ever wrote. He couldn't get anyone to publish it because of the content of it. And it's an extraordinary book. And he culminated, really, this whole period of radical press criticism. But if it was just a problem for democracy, it wouldn't have changed the system. It also became a problem for commercial newspaper publishing. The large newspaper publishers were facing a dilemma. If people didn't trust their newspapers, they wouldn't buy them. They wouldn't buy the advertisers. It became bad for business. And this is the groundswell to understand the solution to that crisis of capitalist journalism, of monopolistic newspapering in the early 20th century. And that solution was professional journalism. That's the birth of objectivity. That's the cauldron that gave birth to the modern notion of nonpartisan journalism. And the revolutionary idea of professional journalism was, for the first time, you take the owner and the editor, who were linked, the one and the same, for the first 120 years of the Republic, and you split them, like splitting the atom. Owners over here with the advertisers making the money, the Chinese wall is here, and on the other side are the editors and the reporters. Separation of church and state. They are not meet. So if you read a newspaper in a monopoly town, you read the front page, you won't know the politics of the owner. It will be neutral, professional journalism. And where will these professional journalists come from? Well, they'll be trained in journalism schools. There were no journalism schools in the United States in 1900. By 1920, every major journalism school had been founded. I bet you Chapel Hills was founded in that period. I'm willing to bet. I know that every other one was in that period. And they were founded because the major newspaper publishers in every state marched to the state capitol and said, we need one of these professional journalism schools so we get a professional journalist while we rack up all the money. And then we'll have a separation between church and state. That's the birth of professional journalism. Now, the notion of objectivity, that you can have absolutely neutral journalism, has been ridiculed. It's been dismissed. It's ludicrous. The idea of taking, it'd be like just like adding up a row of numbers. If I gave you 2 plus 3 plus 2, you'd all come up with 7, hopefully. The idea of objective journalism is like you'd all go out and see the world like 2 plus 2 or 2. You'd come in and write an identical story of seeing it. That's nonsensical. No one would make that claim for journalism now. The claim for professional journalism is that it can be fair, accurate, and nonpartisan. And that's not necessarily bad. I don't think there's anything wrong with being fair, accurate, and nonpartisan. I don't think it's the only type of journalism we need, but I don't think it's necessarily dismissed as that's bad, that's awful. The problem with professional journalism, as it's been practiced in the United States, is that it's smuggled in certain crucial biases into what's considered fair, accurate, nonpartisan journalism that have actually made it not fair, not accurate, and not nonpartisan. That's the problem with professional journalism as it's developed in the United States. The professional code that emerged in the progressive era and that is crucial to understanding journalism to this day, and you'll see it really explains most of the coverage we're going to see, builds in the biases, the political interests of the owners and the advertisers, but it makes journalists oblivious to the compromises of the authority they make because they're just going about the professional code. And this is absolutely crucial to understanding what's going on. Ben Bagdikian, who wrote a book called The Media Monopoly, and I hope Malaprops has that. If it does, you should make a run on it tonight because it's a great book, really has the best discussion of these biases that are built into the professional code of journalism. Bagdikian is a former editor of the Washington Post, then the dean of the University of California School of Journalism, and one of the single most thoughtful writers on issues in journalism. He says there are three crucial biases built into the professional code of journalism in that era that become the rule through to this day. First, and for the first time, stories are based on credentialed facts, or what are called official sources. News political coverage is based on what people in power say, period. That's the basis of journalism. And this is absolutely important for professional journalism for a couple reasons. First of all, it takes the controversy away from story selection, so you no longer can complain. Why do you run that story? You say, hey, the governor said it. We had to cover it. We report. You decide. So it takes the controversy away from story selection. We just report what people in power say. Secondly, it's a lot cheaper to cover. You just plant a reporter at the White House, a reporter at City Hall, a reporter at the Capitol, a reporter at some place where people in power congregate and report what they say that day. And that's your news hole. It's a lot cheaper than having reporters go out and cover us, dig up stories, find out what's actually happening in the community. So it's a very conducive system for professional commercial journalism. But it has real problems built into it. You can probably already see them if you just think about it for a second. It gives sources a lot of power. They become the assignment editors of journalism. If they're talking about something, you report it. If they're mum on something, you really can't report it. It's hard to report. It makes journalists very reluctant critics of their crucial sources. The range of debate, therefore, in our journalism tends to volley between the range of debate among elite opinion or official sources. That tends to be a strong bias built into our journalism. Now, look what happens to a journalist, and we'll see tangible examples of this later on when I talk about the war, the world war against terrorism we're in right now. A journalist who goes outside the range of official opinion and tries to introduce a new idea that no one in power is talking about, what are they accused of? Of being unprofessional, of bringing their own partisan opinion in. it's a real disciplinary thing to stay within the range of elite opinion, or else you're going to be accused of being unprofessional and partisan. So what journalists have to do, the smart ones, if they want to somehow raise an issue that no one's talking about, they've got to coax someone in power to mention it so they can use them as a source and claim they're just reporting what that person says. That's a trick of journalism for those of you who are planning to go into the profession. It happens all the time. Good journalists do that. That's how they get their stories in there, the good ones, when people in power don't want to talk about something. I mean, this is a crucial factor for understanding the news coverage of the recent election in Florida, for example, and we'll get to that in a second. If you understand sourcing, you understand 90% of why the coverage was so terrible and why it was so weak. And one other point on this, and I'll move on, this reliance on official sources. Let me give you an example of how much it's changed. In the 1870s, for example, the White House and the president accounted for 1 or 2% of the news hole in American newspapers. 1 or 2% of the news dealt with the White House. By 1925, we got pretty much to the point we are today. 25% of the news hole is the White House. Now, is the president doing 25 times as much stuff now, especially this one? No, of course not. What's happening, though, is you've got all the reporters there. So they're just waiting there reporting what's being fed to them by the White House public office, information office. That's why you have so much more coverage. Back in 1870, you wouldn't cover the White House just for the heck of it. You'd have to have a reason. And if you thought the president said something stupid, you wouldn't cover it. You'd say, that guy's an idiot. I'm not going to cover him. It's a partisan press. I think the guy's a moron. You don't want to cover him? Read another paper. That's a different world of journalism then. The second factor, one other point on that, and I'll go on. Good ties with sources then are crucial if you're going to be a successful journalist. You don't want to antagonize your sources. If you piss them off too much, they won't talk to you anymore, and then you can't be a journalist, because then you can only report one side, you're partisan, you're not a professional journalist. And this has evolved in the United States to a very deplorable situation where journalism now considers it legitimate just to simply report both sides of what's being said, not investigate whether they're telling the truth. And we saw this in Florida, James Baker going, well, these Democrats, they just want to keep counting the ballots over and over until they win. And they'd report that all the time. They'd be on the air, and the Democrats would give their mealy-mouthed nonsense you can never understand. But people watching at home would just hear, gosh, yeah, there's funny Democrats just want to keep counting the votes again, and the Democrats can't seem to figure out what they're doing. But no reporter went out and said, well, is that true? Because it wasn't true. You just report what this side says and this side says. You're a stenographer to people in power, then that's your job. Real journalism, you'd actually tell us if that's true. But if they do that, they'll piss off their sources. And then those sources won't talk to them next time. So there's a built-in pressure not to do the hard digging that good journalism should do. And we really suffer by that. The second bias Bagdikian talks about that built into the professional code is the fear of context. Because when you put stories in context, it almost requires that you take some sort of ideological, moral, or political position. It's very difficult to talk about an issue long-term historically, putting it in context, without having a position on it. So you look at scholars like myself. If I write a book or any scholar writes a book, it's impossible to be neutral or objective. You have values. You have an argument. When you put it in context, it comes out. You're establishing it. You're developing it. It's very difficult to avoid. For journalism, though, that's bad because it gives you the controversy of being biased. It gets you in hot water. So you avoid context as much as possible. You argue that news needs a news peg to be covered. There has to be an event, a news peg, or a news hook to justify coverage. And as a result, long-term stories of crucial significance to our society tend to slip through the cracks in our journalism. Suburban sprawl. What a crucial story. I mean, I don't know what it's like in Asheville, but in most places in this country, like Charlotte, I guess, apparently is a classic example of this, we're mowing down countryside incredibly fast in a sort of a brain-dead process. I don't know where it ends until we have no farmland or country left. You know, it's 68 years. No rational planning. But it's not really a news story. It's been going on for 50 years. I mean, in some cities it's been disastrous already. But it only becomes a news story if there's a bill being debated or a demonstration. It's a long-term story like that. To cover it invites a charge that you're being biased. Why are you raising that issue? No one in power is talking about it. You got an axe to grind? You're not being professional. Or another classic issue Bagdikian loves to talk about, racism. Bagdikian, when he worked at the Washington Post, would travel around from newsroom to newsroom, and he'd go in and talk to the editors. And he'd go into the editorial offices in Detroit or Cleveland or Chicago, and he'd say, this is like in the late 50s, and he'd say, well, let me see the articles you've written on racism in your community. And the editors would look at him, sort of like, we don't have racism in our community. No stories on that. Well, yeah. What are you talking about? You didn't hear everyone in Chicago? That's a joke, so you understand. Yeah. That was meant to be a punchline. Or Cleveland or Detroit or Milwaukee. I don't mean to pick on Chicago. In fact, Dickie said, well, that's sort of interesting. They had no stories because it was a long-term problem. It didn't affect their core readership. They didn't care about it. There wasn't a news peg or a news hook. Well, 5 years later, it's the most covered story in all those cities. You've got riots, you've got demonstrations, you've got political organizing, race is the number one issue. It just fell through the cracks for 30 years, not covered at all. So the people in those cities were completely unprepared to deal with this crucial crisis. It was a real weak spot of our journalism. A good journalism would have had us up to speed on a social issue of that magnitude. And this sort of journalism, this sort of just the facts, ma'am, stay away from context. Don't blame us. We report the facts, you decide. Really helps promote a depoliticization. It takes the passion, the ideas, the morality, the values, what's interesting about politics, and strips it out and leaves you with just these sanitized, meaningless facts. It's a real problem. It's part of the process that promotes the demoralization and the depoliticization of our society. And it also promotes another institution of crucial importance in our society, public relations. The PR industry is born at the exact moment of professional journalism, and it's not a coincidence. So what does the PR industry do? It provides expert sources for its clients so you can get favorable press coverage using professional code conventions. It provides news hooks. It provides news pegs. The PR industry is there to basically serve its largely corporate clientele with favorable press coverage. And you read the paper, I think it's just quality journalism. The studies of news holes or of news in our society show that 40 to 70% of all the news stories you see are directly from public relations press releases. 40 to 70%. Now, the owners of our media love PR. The captains of the media industry, why? It saves them a fortune. If they didn't have PR funneling all this good material, then they'd have to have reporters actually go out and cover something. Where PR saves them a ton of time. It saves them a ton of money. And it produces dreadful journalism for us. Absolutely horrible. And then the third bias is the most abstract. In many ways, though, it's the most important. Even with the first two biases, towards official sources, towards lack of context, you still have to decide what goes in the front page, what goes in page 7, and what doesn't get covered. There's no way around the fact that there have to be values. You simply have to have some explanation why that's an important story and that isn't, beyond those things I've just talked about. And Bagdikian argues that there's a bias that he calls dig here, not there. Implicit into the professional code are biases in certain directions, and journalists take them as natural. And his core argument is what's privileged in the professional code is legitimate journalism is government malfeasance, and what's off limits is corporate malfeasance. What's privileged is government malfeasance, certain types of government malfeasance. CIA wouldn't count. Certain types of government malfeasance, but not corporate malfeasance. Now, how do you test that? How do you say, well, journalists given equal stories, one about corporate malfeasance, one about government malfeasance, won't cover corporate, but will cover government? How do you test that? I mean, that's hard to prove. That sounds sort of interesting, but what evidence do you have? Well, history's been extraordinarily generous to us in this matter. There's a great journalist named Charles Lewis, a former 60 Minutes producer, has won a lot of awards, one of the most acclaimed broadcast journalist producers in the last 40 years. He got frustrated with the limits placed upon him by CBS at 60 Minutes, and about a decade ago, he left and he started a group called the Center for Public Integrity. Some of you might have heard of it. They have a great website, Center for Public Integrity. You can look them up. And what Lewis did, because he has such a great reputation, he was able to raise a fortune from foundations to hire like 15 crack investigative journalists. And what they do is they do four or five big reports every year as investigative journalists. They write these 50-page reports, and then they distribute them to the entire mass media, news media, and say, guys, here's the story, follow up on it. It's all yours. And that's what they do. He broke, for example, the Lincoln bedroom story. That their group broke the idea that Clinton was leasing out the Lincoln bedroom to raise money. They're a nonpartisan. They go after Democrats. They go after Republicans. But they also do one other thing that no other journalists do. They go after corporations. Charles Lewis is a great journalist. He thinks private power should be held accountable, not just public power. Corporations that rule our economy, we have a right to know how they operate, how they interact with government policymakers. And so about half of their reports they do are about the same journalists are about corporate malfeasance, and about half are about public. And Lewis says it's really interesting. When they do one of their reports on government malfeasance, they'll have a press conference, the room will be packed, there'll be cameras from all the networks, their phones will be ringing off the hook, emails humming, the computer smoking, everything rocking. He says, then they do one about corporate malfeasance, and one of them, by the way, was an expose of the corporate media lobby and how it basically owns all the politicians. When they do one on corporate malfeasance, he says you can hear a pin drop in their office. No one comes to the press conference, doesn't get picked up, no one covers it. Same journalists, same quality of research. I mean, this is really a controlled experiment. No coverage. And if Chuck Lewis wasn't a principled man, he'd stop doing those ones. He says, funders say, gee, Chuck, why do you keep doing these things about corporate malfeasance? No one's running him. Why do you go back to the Lincoln bedroom? But he says, no, I'm a journalist, and if I'm going to do journalism, I'm doing the whole package. It's just because he's a person of unusual integrity that we get this and get that test. But it points to this bias. It's an example of the bias that's built in. Corporate power is more or less off limits, much like Communist Party power was off limits in the Soviet media. In Pravda, there's Vestia. You get roughly the same treatment of corporate power in our media. Now, the professional system took a long time to get in place. It really took until the middle of the 20th century before you got through all these owners who used their news media as personal platforms. The Chicago Tribune is a classic case in point, one of our great newspapers owned by Colonel McCormick, who was really a pretty dubious figure. And he liked to use his newspaper to proselytize his own particular brand of politics. To give some sense of where this guy was coming from, when his European correspondent, his favorite European correspondent, left working for him in the 1920s and 30s, covering Europe for the Chicago Tribune, when Hitler came to power, this guy defected to the Nazis to work for Hitler. This is the Chicago Tribune's European correspondent. That's where Colonel McCormick was coming from politically. But when he died, the Chicago Tribune became an exemplar of professional journalism. In fact, the Chicago Tribune building in Chicago, if you've ever seen it, it's a lovely building, has two separate entrances, one for the business side, one for the editors and reporters. So they don't even rub shoulders with each other. They don't even bump into each other in the bathroom. That's real separation of church and state. And the Chicago Tribune is a charter member now. They're right there. They're good standing. It's a professional news medium. But in fairness to professional journalism, this system, this professional code, it looks awfully good compared to what it replaced. It looks the Chicago Tribune looked a lot better after Colonel McCormick than it did when he had this Nazi guy writing for it. Much of our news media looked a lot better once it became professional, because what preceded it was partisan, it was sensationalistic, it was trashy. So it did have a lot going for it. And there are some strengths to professional journalism. Factual accuracy. An emphasis on that, some independence, and some very good reporting. The best reporting in professional journalism is where elites disagree. When you have elite or official sources disagreeing, it gives journalists a lot of wiggle room to work, and the best journalists can get in there and do great work. That's the groundswell for the best sort of journalism. The weakest area for professional journalism, however, tends to be where elites agree. And this is where professional journalism, or the professional code of journalism we have in this country, looks really bad. When our elites are in agreement on a crucial issue and don't want to talk about it or say the exact same thing, it gives journalists almost no wiggle room to get around it. And then it's really, our journalism is not too far from what you would find in an authoritarian society in terms of actual content. What sort of things are off limits? What sort of things do elites agree upon that are not debated in our news media as a result? Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. One of them. There's sort of a belief among the elite in this country and official sources and the Republicans and Democrats that the United States and the United States alone has a 007 right to invade any country it wants at any time for any reason. Now, we're the only country in the world that gets this right. Now, sometimes we can deputize another country, but no one else is allowed to do it but us. Imagine if Paraguay said, hey, we're going to go invade Venezuela because they got a bunch of terrorists there. No, sorry, guys, we do that. Back to Paraguay for you, unless we give you permission. We are alone. Now, that's because to the elites of this country, the U.S. government is sort of there to protect their interests, to make sure governments fall in line to represent their interests around the world. And this is an issue that's never, therefore, debated in our news media. The classic case was the invasion of Panama back in, was it 1989? 7 invasions ago, for those keeping score at home. And the day of the invasion, I was watching C-SPAN. And then Secretary of State James Baker, was giving a press conference. And this is where C-SPAN's great, because they show the entire press conference. This is really great. And he's getting the usual questions about Noriega, and did you catch him, and how many casualties are there? You know, the sort of stuff, you know, you could just mail the questions in, the same boilerplate questions they always get, right? You know, who did the president consult with? Did he talk to the prime minister of England yet? You know, all that sort of stuff. And it was the usual ho-hum garbage. You didn't learn anything from it. And then sort of at the end, he's just about to close down, and you can see this woman in the back, this like college girl raising her hand frantically. And he goes, okay, you. And you could tell just at the moment that he regretted it. Then she stands up, and she's sort of nervous. And she goes, Secretary of State Baker, I'm holding... Clearly she was like from a college paper or a union paper, one of these left-wing rags. Somehow she got in the room. I'm holding here a copy of the Organization of American States Treaty the United States signed. And it says that any country that signs this will not invade another signatory. Panama also signed it. Baker sort of nodded. Then I'm holding here a copy of the U.S. Constitution.
says that if you break a treaty, that's grounds for impeachment and treason. And now, James Baker was absolutely stunned because that question had never been asked by a reporter to an American Secretary of State for 30 years. That's simply not that's a question you don't ask. A good reporter knows you don't ask that question. You just internalize it. You don't even think of it. Now, Baker sat there, and he looked at her sort of that Dan Quayle look for about 10 seconds. He didn't really know how to respond. And this, I'm not going to make up what he said. This is unbelievable. He looked at her, and then he goes, this guy's really slick. He goes, we'll have our lawyers look into it and get back to you. And that was the end of it. And that's the last time that question's ever been asked, and it will never be asked again. Because we alone have the 007 right to invade any country we want at any time for any reason, and it's not even discussed. We just, you know, we're God's chosen empire, just like Rome was. Now it's us. Another thing you'll never see debated in our news media is that capitalism equals democracy. Because to the elite of this country, capitalism does equal democracy. They don't care about democracy. They care about capitalism, but they call it democracy because, no, we care about democracy. Capitalism equals democracy. Even though there's so much evidence shows that they don't equal each other. In fact, they're oftentimes in serious tension and conflict, especially with the sort of free market neoliberal policies that have wreaked havoc upon so many places in the world. But to our elite, that's irrelevant. The whole, what they call democracy means basically where U.S. commercial interests rule the country, or commercial interests rule. In the political system, ideally they'll have elections, but, you know, if the elections don't come out right, screw it. Democracy means our guys run the country. We've had it. Now you say, oh, Bob, that's not being fair. Well, consider this. We have some good evidence recently. Anyone been watching what happened in Venezuela in the last month? Yeah, well, you guys know the story. Yeah, I mean, yeah. This is an extraordinary case study of this phenomenon. You have a popularly elected government in Venezuela under Hugo Chavez, a populist government. Now, I don't know much about Chavez. He might be a schmuck. He might be a great guy, but he's popularly elected. It's a constitutional government. He hasn't violated the Constitution. He's a populist. He's hostile to U.S. oil interests. He's explicit about that. He got elected to mess with him. That's why he's won this big election. That's the case. The U.S. elite despise the guy. The Venezuelan elite despise the guy, and they want to get rid of him. They don't want to wait for another election. They probably don't think they could win another election. So they say, whatever we do, let's overthrow this guy. Let's get rid of him. They overthrow him. And the next morning, in an editorial in the New York Times and the Washington Post that I think must have been written before the coup, because they came out literally within hours of the coup taking place, the New York Times and Washington Post both applauded this coup. And you say, well, that's sort of interesting. Popular government overthrown by a coup, in its place installed the president of the Chamber of Commerce of Venezuela, who immediately suspends the Constitution, abolishes all the local elected governments in the country, and abolishes the elected parliament. And this is the first thing he does in power. And the New York Times editorial says that this was, you know, a healthy step to restoration of democracy, this coup in Venezuela. A healthy step in the restoration of democracy. Because it's secret. In the bottom of the sentence, you get the truth. The truth, which is, they say, this new government will have encourage entrepreneurial initiative. That's the kicker. The key thing is they'll protect capitalism. They'll protect the interests of the rich to run the country like they've been running it and don't get messed up with all this populist mumbo jumbo. So those are the things that won't be debated in our news media. And those are crucial things for us. I mean, we're the world's biggest military power, yet the crucial issues are sort of off limits. You won't hear them debated in our news media. It leaves us with one hand tied behind our back as a society trying to come to terms with these issues. There are some other things you won't see in our news media either. There's a Sicilian code in our news media. Thou shalt not cover local billionaires critically. I mean, that is the 11th commandment of the news media. And that's true all across the country. No local media is going to tangle with local billionaires or corporations. They always kiss up to them everywhere. This is for obvious reasons. They're usually important advertisers. They're pals with the local publisher. Their kids go to the same school. They live in the same gated community. This is the world they work in. It's not good business to upset the largest business in your community if you're publishing a medium, a newspaper, or running a TV station. So thou shalt not do critical work on local billionaires or local corporations. The problem for this is if Asheville doesn't do critical work on its local businesses and what they're doing, who else is going to? I mean, the Wichita paper's not going to come in here and investigate them. So it means they sort of get off with kid gloves treatment. Now, occasionally we get examples that show us what happens when you violate the Sicilian code here. There's a guy named Mike Gallagher in Cincinnati who writes for the Cincinnati Inquirer. A few years ago, he did an expose on the Chiquita Banana Company, which talked about how the Chiquita Banana Company, to enhance its business prospects,
would assassinate people, pay for the assassination of political opponents in third world countries. True story. It was true he did that, and it was true what he wrote. The problem that Mike Gallagher made when the Cincinnati Inquirer ran this was that the Chiquita Banana Company is owned by Carl Lindner, the richest guy in Cincinnati. Big problem. Worth $4 billion. Carl Lindner, you know, this is like James Baker. He's never had anything but smoke blown up his butt by the local media. He turns around, now all of a sudden he's running a hit squad. What they do at the Chiquita Banana Company is they find out that this reporter has gotten some of the information through access to voicemail he shouldn't have had. He didn't get official permission. So the Cincinnati Inquirer, and it was an enormously ridiculous step, disavowed his entire story on the basis of the fact that he got a couple quotes through using voicemail improperly, even though the story was true. And believe me, they don't do any more stories at the Cincinnati Inquirer on the Chiquita Banana Company. They might after Lindner sells it, but not till then. And after he sells it, they probably won't be interested in it. I remember a few years ago when that first book that Wally so graciously touted in the introduction came out, I got an award for it, and I went to the awards dinner at Fordham. And at the awards dinner was the woman who was the news director for the station that won the award as the best local TV news in America. Now, granted, that sort of is like winning the award as best ice hockey player in Nigeria. But she won this award. And she said, when she got the award, she was really a cool woman. She was very honest. She said, "I'll be honest with you. I really appreciate getting all this praise. But there are certain stories I absolutely won't cover on our station. We will not do anything with any major advertiser, especially auto dealers. I've told our reporters to stay away from those issues." And I appreciated her honesty. Usually you get a layer of BS 14 miles wide before you get to the truth. Maybe that's why she was so successful. She just laid it right out on the table. It was quite striking. So the corporate attack that I'm about to get to isn't responsible for all the problems of journalism. Lots of them are embedded into this professional code that really push journalism in a certain way. So that even stories that get lots of resources, like the Florida case in 2000, have really dreadful coverage. And let's go through the 2000 election, because I think this is really a bellwether moment for understanding the deep flaws in professional journalism. What happened in Florida? Well, Al Gore won the state. We know for sure that the majority of the people who went to vote that day in Florida, who got up, woke up, said, "I'm going to go vote," and the majority of the people who legally filed their absentee ballots on time by that day, we know for sure a majority of them intended to vote for Al Gore. In fact, the evidence for this is overwhelming. I urge you all to read a book called Jews for Buchanan by John Nichols that New Press published. If you want to, well, it's a very serious book. He goes through the recount almost ballot by ballot to discuss this issue. Al Gore won the election in Florida. He won it nationally. Yet, if you looked at our press coverage, George Bush won it. And he won it in Florida, and he won it, therefore, nationally. And he's the just and legitimate president. And how could that be? How could our journalism, in fact, almost cheer on the Bush case? They're so eager to have it close. What happened to this idea of a feisty fourth estate that's going to tell us the truth for those of us who just want to know who got the most votes and represent our interests? You know, it feels the same whether it was Bush or Gore, Gore or Bush. I just want to know who won the darn thing. Who got the most votes, period. Don't give me a lot of gobbledygook. Who won the thing? Journalists, get off your butts and go find out. For those of us who think that's what the press should do, we had no dogs in that race. Journalists weren't doing that. We were out of luck. Why was the coverage so deplorable? How is it so deplorable? Well, the fundamental starting point is official sources. Journalists, what passes for journalism, basically every day would go get the Republican Party line, and they get the Democratic Party line, and they'd report that. They wouldn't investigate the claims, almost never. There's very little investigation done. Just report this party line, report that party line, present them. We report, you decide. So what were they reporting? Well, remember this. It was a tie, basically, in the first vote. I mean, was it 300 votes, 500 votes? But in a state, 6 million votes, that's a statistical tie, basically. You have no idea who was going to win based on what they knew. But in the middle of the night, Fox News declared George W. Bush the winner. At 3 a.m., I think it was, declared George W. Bush the winner. You know who made that decision for Fox News? John Ellis, first cousin of George W. Bush. You know that, don't you? Come on. Yeah. Now, this was a totally unsubstantiated call. You can't statistically make a call based on a 500-vote lead out of 6 million votes. It's just absurd. We saw recounts in Washington State, much smaller turnout of vote, 10,000 votes turned around in the Cantwell race on a recount. She was trailing, then she won the race. This is 6 million votes in Florida of all states. Florida. And this guy called it for George W. Bush. But that was absolutely crucial because the media framing for the Republicans thereafter, and therefore for the media, was George W. Bush won it. Al Gore is trying to figure out a way to steal it or get it back somehow. And when the reporters from November 7th until the Supreme Court had its interesting vote on it, reporters would go to Republicans every day and they'd go to Democrats every day. The Republicans every day would say, we won the darn thing and the Democrats are trying to steal it. The Democrats every day would say, you don't really know. I guess we have to count the votes. We're not really sure. We don't want to hurt the stock market or anything. And we don't really want anyone to be too upset. We just want to get at the truth here. Then they go back to the Republicans. These goddamn idiots got their lawyers trying to steal it. We want it. We want to get gone with this thing. We're going to get going here. So if you're an American citizen, you're reading the newspapers, you're reading one side constantly saying we want it, the other side saying we aren't really sure what happened. Logically, I mean, most people say, yeah, the Republicans probably won it. These Democrats don't seem to know what they're talking about. The Republicans were united in a way propagandistically that boggles the imagination. So, I mean, every Republican in the country had the same line every day. Whether it was Rush Limbaugh or Newt Gingrich or Tom DeLay or Trent Lott or James Baker, down to some Republican dog catcher in Montana. They all had said the same thing. So one day, once they get a favorable ruling in the state Supreme Court, well, this is clearly a state Supreme Court case. And then they get a bad ruling in the state Supreme Court. Clearly, this is not a state Supreme Court case. And it's like, you know, is there any accountability here, guys? Anything would go. James Baker, as I said, say, the Democrats just want to keep recounting the votes. They counted them three times already. Well, in fact, a lot of the votes were never counted in that so-called recount, we now know. They did a bogus recount then. It was completely fraudulent. But no one investigated that. That's real journalism. Don't just report what the two sides say. Investigate whether they're telling the truth. That's what we needed, and we didn't get that. I'll give you a couple of crucial examples. Journalists were penalized by the Democrats' unwillingness to play hardball, to fight for what we now know they won. So a great story came out in November of 2000 by the journalist Greg Palast, an American working in England for the BBC and for the Mirror and the Guardian and the Observer. He writes for all of them. And some of you are probably familiar with this story. Palast discovered that for the first time in American history, Catherine Harris had outsourced making a list of all the felons who would not be allowed to vote in the Florida election. She outsourced it to a company that's purely coincidental, owned and operated by all Republicans. And they came up with a list of 57,700 names of felons in Florida who should not be allowed to vote. One small problem. The list was largely bogus. They discovered that there were tons of names there that are people who weren't felons. They also found out that in the instructions it was so loose that if their names even close to it, they called them felons. It was not done with anywhere near the care. And thousands of voters, largely almost all poor and significantly African-American or Latino, went to the polls on election day and weren't allowed to vote, wrongly. We know this. It's heavily documented. A great piece by Palast in the March 2002 Harper's Magazine, if you want to read more about it. Yet, why wasn't that an issue in November? Well, it wasn't an issue because the Democrats didn't want to fight on it. Al Gore didn't go on TV and slam his fists on the table and say, darn it, this is wrong that these people weren't allowed to vote. It cost us the election. It's not fair. We have to do something about it. It's not acceptable. Al Gore, and we can debate why he did this, decided not to do that. And because of that, journalists didn't have source cover to go after that story. So if a journalist tried to push that story, and I know journalists who tried to, they say, hey, you're being partisan. You're not being objective. You're not being professional. Even Al Gore is not raising this issue. It must not be a real story. If it was a real story, Al Gore would be pushing it. So it didn't get covered. The great story was Palast said that a CBS producer called him up in late November and said, this is a great story, Palast. We want to cover this. And Palast said, go for it. And the CBS reporter, or producer in this case, who wins my Pravda Award for the year, replied, well, you know, we called up Governor Jeb Bush's office and asked him about it. He said there was nothing to it. So we decided not to pursue the story. I'm not making this stuff up. I can't make this stuff up. Or here's another story that wasn't investigated. The cost score, clearly thousands, tens of thousands of votes. Did you know that the voting machines in predominantly black counties discharged, threw away a much higher percentage of the ballots than the voting machines in predominantly white and Republican counties? Because they had older machines, they had newer machines. You know, a certain percentage of ballots are always thrown out. You might have voted, not had your vote count once, because they just get tossed out as being improperly marked. In some of the black counties, as high as 10 or 12% of the votes thrown out. Some of the white counties as low as 0.1%. I mean, that was the range. In the black counties, the predominantly black and Democratic counties had a much higher rate. Now, when Ann Coulter and some of the other wise commentators of our news media addressed this issue, you might recall what they said. And I'm going to paraphrase. Well, those dumb Negroes don't know how to vote. So they were probably all fired up and they scratched something, so it got thrown out because they blew it. You know, if they were smarter like us, they would have voted the right way. We can't help it if some dummy can't figure out how to fill out a ballot. Remember, that's all they basically were implying. Well, Greg, no journalist actually did any research on this. No journalist got off their duff and went and looked at these machines and actually see the truth of it. They just simply reported this comment by Republicans and Ann Coulter, so it must be true. And we know what they discovered? They discovered that on these machines, in many of the counties, was a button, especially the newer machines, that if a ballot was, there was something wrong with it, it was sent right back to the voter and they could vote again. They throw that away and vote again in the new machines. And in the black districts, it just swallowed it up, you lost your vote. It was that simple. But no reporter researched that. That's just elementary journalism. They just printed what the two people in power said. As I said, a stolen election. Since the Supreme Court decision, our media, of course, has been this obsession with healing, with closure, obsession with, like, not stepping on the toes of our maximum leader. And when they announced the official recount a year after the election, remember the press coverage of that in November of last year, it was striking. The New York's Time story. Gore Vidal has a wonderful piece I urge you all to read in The Nation. You can get it online. Go to thenation.com, enter Gore Vidal in the search engine, and read his coverage of the New York Times reporting of the official recount that was done of the Florida ballot. Because he goes paragraph by paragraph, breaking it down. Because you go by the 16th paragraph, they admit Gore won the state. But if you read the first 11 paragraphs, it's all about how it's impossible to say Bush won this way, Gore won that way. But in the end, they say, but if you count all the ballots, Gore won. But any way you do it. But the lead wasn't that. Because why wasn't the lead that? Because they admitted that Gore won the state, then they've got a lot to answer for. Why? Where the hell were you guys in November of 2000? Why the heck, when it counted, didn't you get the truth out? You should have. You had every journalist in the country down there reporting what James Baker ate for breakfast. Why couldn't one of you actually do some journalism and get to the truth of the matter? So that wasn't due to corporate control necessarily. Well, that might be an influence. I mean, the recent pressures. But really, a lot of the other stories, some of the problems go to the more commercial pressure, the corporate pressure on journalism. And what's happened since the mid-1980s is very simple. Remember church and state, owner, business, editors, reporters, Chinese wall between them? Well, that deal made a lot of sense for 50 years. By the 1980s, and certainly into the 1990s, what increasingly happened was new big companies would buy out news media. And CBS would get bought by Lawrence Tisch, then it gets bought by Viacom. Newspaper chains get bought by larger chains. And as these companies pay more and more, like Sumner Redstone pays $30 or $40 billion to buy CBS, and then he's over here, here's the Chinese wall, and here's the CBS News, he's saying, hey, what's the story with this deal? You know, I just paid a fortune for this company. Now, my sports teams, my MTV, my film studio, my video rental, Blockbuster, all these executives are forced to maximize return for me, for my investors. So what's this church and state mumbo-jumbo? These guys can do whatever the heck they want. Who came up with this crazy idea? And that's been the logic that's affected the owners of all our media. They're saying, this deal doesn't make sense for us anymore. And they've torn down that wall between church and state. And they said, you guys have to start generating profit for us. We're in this thing to make money. We're not a philanthropy. We're not a charity. And we've seen tremendous pressure on journalism to become a profit source, much greater than it had been the case in the past. How do you do that? Well, you reduce costs, for starters. You lower costs. The best way to do that is lay off as many editorial people as possible. Lay off as many editorial people as possible. Lower budgets. Lower budgets. One of the crucial things that got cut out starting in the mid-80s, something we're suffering with today, is the elimination of foreign news from our news media. The virtual elimination of foreign news from the mid-80s to this day. And it still exists, despite the hot air you're getting to the contrary. I mean, the statistics are striking. I've got them in the book. I mean, it's like 60-70% drop-off in the number of foreign correspondents. The amount of time and space on foreign news in our news media in 15 years dropped by 40-60%. It's just not covered anymore. What passes for foreign coverage in our news media in the new world order is you take a superstar correspondent, you fly them into the zone, you airdrop them, you get them in front of a visual. They mouth whatever the State Department person told them on the way in the limo. They get back in the limo, get back in the chopper, back to the airport, back to New York. That's foreign coverage nowadays. You know, that's bogus. Real foreign coverage is someone who knows the country, knows the language, knows the people, really understands what's going on. And the worst part about investigative journalism is not that it won't break a story, but it might break a story. It might actually break a really important story about someone in power. And then it gets you in hot water with someone you're playing croquet with or someone you're selling ads to, or someone your daughter's going to marry. It's just not good business. Bad business. So you see a lot less of it. Journalism, in fact, is a dying art altogether. I get a kick out of the Fox News Channel, which is sort of the new state of journalism. They don't do any journalism in the Fox News Channel. They just pontificate. They don't actually cover much. It's just punditry. They don't really break stories. They don't really get into anything. In fact, punditry journalism with star brands is sort of the rage today, especially on television. A cover of inside horse race politics, schmoozing with the powerful, celebrity journalists. It's an appalling situation. For some of our younger people in the audience, some of the old-timers will remember this. There was once a great journalist in this country named I.F. Stone, a dominant journalist in the 40s, 50s, 60s. I.F. Stone had a policy that he would never socialize with anyone he covered in Washington. He wouldn't even interview them if he could help it. He simply worked with the public records. He simply did digging in the archives and in libraries because he knew once he started socializing with them, hey, how's it going, Louie? Oh, your kid got into Harvard. Great, great, yeah. What, you want to go do some lawn bowling later? Once he got into that environment, he couldn't be as good a journalist. He would compromise him because he's, human beings are like that. That's a nice thing about us. We're nice people. We don't want to screw over someone we know. We should be proud of that. He understood if he got into that relationship, he wouldn't be as good a journalist. So he refused to have social interaction. Well, he couldn't get a job as a dog catcher at the Washington Post today or any of these corporate news media. The whole key is to be schmoozing with the powerful. You know, the whole key is who's the Andrea Mitchell marries Alan Greenspan. I mean, that's the new world order of journalism. Likewise, what we've seen is a real softening up of the standards for news stories in the last 10 or 15 years. What is considered a legitimate news story has changed quite a bit. And it's really, on one hand, we're seeing an increase of sort of using the news media to promote a media empire's interest. Just this morning, interestingly enough, I was watching CNN on this great hotel Wally put me up in. I think it's in the process of being foreclosed. And through the flicker of the television screen, I could manage to pick out the story. And it was an art story on CNN about how how women use the computer more than men in the household and more than their children. Housewives are now the leading users of computers in families. And basically they had an AOL executive on, and it was a five-minute interview touting AOL on CNN. I mean, it was just blatant. I was astonished. Blatant advertisement for CNN. For AOL on CNN. Well, AOL owns CNN. It's AOL Time Warner. There's a classic, another example, this comes with NBC. In 1996, the Summer Olympics. In 1996, they do a survey at the end of the year of the most covered stories on network news for each of the networks and for CNN, the top 10, who gives them the most time. In 1996, the Summer Olympics was the number one story covered on NBC News. The 1996 Summer Olympics is the number one story covered in their nightly news for that year, 1996.